But you'll talk a lot less. I'm Dr. Ray.
Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
Hudson, welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us.
Guest is Ralph Reed, who is well known nationally as a political leader. But I just want to say before I bring him on that Ralph Reed understands American politics better than anyone I know, and I mean anyone. He's founder and chairman of the Faith and Freedom Coalition. Many listeners will know him from his years as executive director of the Christian Coalition, which is thought to be the most effective national grassroots political organization ever launched for the people of faith. Ralph, welcome to Church and Culture.
Thanks so much, Gio. Good to be with you.
This is actually your second visit. You were here on one of the inaugural programs a year and a half ago. But we're having you back today because things don't look so good for the people of faith, for Christians, for Catholics, Jews, Mormons, who care about life, who care about marriage, who care about the values of our culture. We've had several disappointing Supreme Court decisions, the most disappointing of which was about gay marriage. How are people, in your view, taking these Supreme Court decisions and that decision specifically?
Well, I think, you know, in a sense, it's a major setback because it is the High Court has redefined the institution of marriage with, you know, major ramifications for the country, obviously, and the culture. And I would argue, you know, ultimately, potentially major ramifications for the practice of the Christian faith and other Orthodox faiths in the United States going forward. I think it will ultimately prove to be a major threat to religious freedom on the one hand. On the other hand, you know, there's really nothing particularly new about the radical left using the federal court system to impose its values by judicial fiat on an unwilling populace after they have been unable to achieve that victory in the court of public opinion, in the halls of Congress and legislatures, or at the ballot box. We saw it with Roe v. Wade. We saw it with Engle versus Vitale, which outlawed prayer in school, in public schools. We saw it in Lee versus Weissman, which was a further danger to religious liberty, which was another school prayer case in the 90s. And we could go on and on, Bill. This is their strategy. I guess the question really is, what's our strategy? And I don't want to give a six-minute answer to that. I've already talked too long in answering that first question. But there is, I want to underscore, there is nothing new about the left strategy of using a divided court to impose the most radical social agenda in the Western world on a country that it is otherwise unable to do so.
I'm talking with Ralph Reed, founder and chairman of the Faith and Freedom Coalition. But, Ralph, what is stinging about this, and I know it's stinging for you personally as it is for me, is that under the leadership and presidency of George W. Bush, we did get several new Supreme Court appointees, which, frankly, was one of the major reasons many of us, yourself, me, millions of others, fought as hard as we did. There's a very big feeling of being let down by one, at least, of those appointees.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that. That's also not new, as you know.
It certainly is not new. No kidding.
No, Sandra Day O'Connor, similarly.
Anthony Kennedy.
Yeah, but also keep this in mind. This was a 5-4 court, not a 6-3 court or a 7-2 court. And none of George W. Bush's appointees betrayed us. He got two, Roberts and Alito. They both voted correctly on the marriage case. And also keep this in mind, and I would press this point really hard. Kennedy only got on the court after Robert Bork was defeated. And his name became a verb for the smearing of a judicial conservative by the left to do what? To keep him off the court so he was not there to cast the right decision. After that, I believe it was, I'm drawing a blank on his name. There was another guy that was nominated by Reagan after Bork was defeated. He then stepped down, and then you got Kennedy. So this was the third bite at the apple. It was a deliberate part of their strategy. It's why they tried to take out Thomas. It's why they did everything they could to keep Miguel Estrada off the D.C. Circuit. The point is, Gil, they will stop at nothing to keep people like Roberts, Alito, Scalia, and Thomas off this court. So there's nothing new about that either.
Of course, Ralph, when I expressed disappointment in Roberts, I was conflating the two court decisions, the Obamacare decision, where Roberts voted in favor of keeping Obamacare in place, which for social conservatives has the immediate effect of keeping federal funding for abortion in place. And there's got to be, you got to feel some disappointment about that.
No question. I mean, look, this is a disappointment. I think the point I'm trying to make is that it's not a shock. It's not a surprise. And I think Scalia was right in his dissent on, I believe it was Lawrence v. Texas, that this was inevitable, you know, based on the reasoning that the court promulgated in the overturning of sodomy laws. I mean, if a particular sexual practice is protected under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, this decision was inevitable. It was only a matter of when, not if, unless we could reconstitute the court.
Which we didn't quite do. If Obama had not gotten a second term, we could have possibly reconstituted the court.
Yeah, and what I would say to my fellow conservatives, I know that there are a lot of people who look at something like this and go, you know, what's the point? We fought for 30 years to reconstitute the courts. Look at all the appointments we got, and we still lost. This is a pointless strategy. I think that's a huge mistake, because we went from a court that before we began this movement deal was legalizing the taking of innocent human life in a mother's womb through abortion on demand by a 7-2 decision. And we took that and turned it into a 5-4, and even that involved the betrayal of a Reagan appointee. And, you know, we need to do a better job of winning at the ballot box, because if you lose two elections, in 08 and 12, you know, you can't be surprised when he puts liberals like Kagan and Sotomayor of that ilk on the court. So the answer is not to throw in the towel on the strategy. The answer is to get better at the strategy. You've got to win elections, and you have to recognize that the judicial confirmation process, as you well know, Deal, is a it is a major battle, which is why they will stop at nothing. It's why they filibustered Estrada. If Estrada had gotten on the D.C. circuit, he would have been there for Bush, meaning 43, to appoint the first Hispanic to the U.S. Supreme Court. They didn't want that. They stopped him, so they got the first Hispanic, and now you see the Hispanic numbers turning because Obama got to make that history.
I'm talking with Ralph Reed, founder and chairman of the Faith and Freedom Coalition, former executive director of the Christian Coalition. Ralph, what do you think the consequence would be of losing this next presidential, especially when there's a good likelihood if we could hold on to both houses of Congress? I mean, in terms of not just the Supreme Court, but in terms of the kind of legislation that could be passed and signed by a pro-life House and a pro-life Senate.
You mean in terms of pro-life legislation?
Yeah, especially the 5-month abortion act.
Well, you know, the thing about abortion is almost large enough to pass a constitutional amendment. And it will pass the Senate, I believe. I'm not sure of that.
It will pass the Senate, but not with enough votes to get to the president's desk.
Is that what will happen?
Yeah, we've got 56 votes right now.
Yeah, so it could pass with a majority vote, assuming they filibuster. It doesn't have the 60 votes, but in a sense, that's almost a formality anyway because Obama vetoed it. Now, I would love to be able to pass it so that Obama was forced to veto it, but it looks like that may not be the case. But we'll see. I mean, we remain cautiously optimistic. And, look, I think it's no different than what we did with partial birth abortion in the 1990s. We passed it, I believe, 2 or 3 times. Clinton vetoed it every time. It was at least twice. It may have been 3 times. Bush became president. He finally signed it. The Supreme Court, I believe, overturned either the federal law or a state partial birth abortion ban. So then we had to go back, respond to the court's reasoning, and pass it again. And
right.
Bush had to sign it a second time. So you're seeing a common theme here, Gil, whether legislatively or in terms of shifting the court. This is a 30, 40, 50, 60, 70-year struggle. Anybody who thinks you're going to pour into the civic arena as people of faith and wave a magic wand or say a prayer, and this thing's going to turn around in a decade, doesn't understand American history. Remember, the NAACP was founded in 1909. They didn't even get a civil rights plank in either party platform until 1948. And it wasn't until 1964 that they realized it was 54 before they got Brown v. Board, and it was 64 before they got the Civil Rights Act.
Women's suffrage, the same thing.
Women's suffrage, the same thing. Temperance, the same thing. Every social reform movement has, it is a marathon, and it is multi-generational. You have one generation that passes the torch on to the next generation, and we see that happening. John Paul II has done that for Roman Catholics, passing the torch on. In my case, in the evangelical world, it's been people like Jerry Falwell and D. James Kennedy and others who are no longer with us. But the fight continues. The struggle continues.
Well, the particular direct harm that you spoke of the gay marriage decision on religious liberty, do you think there will actually be a move by the same gay lobbying forces that brought about this decision to strip churches of their tax-exempt status?
Well, I believe either the Solicitor General or the Assistant Solicitor General for the Obama administration, in oral argument, was asked that direct question. If memory serves me, it was by Alito, but it could have been one of the other justices. If we rule that this is that gays and lesbians are a protected class for 14th Amendment purposes, isn't it the case that you would have to, that there would have to be an effort to strip favorable treatment for those who deny that right. And the person arguing before the court for the Obama administration said that would probably be the case. Now, whether there will be or not, I don't know, but that's already in the court record. And think about this deal. I go back to what Scalia said in his dissent in the Lawrence v. Texas case, which, as you know, is what led the Massachusetts High Court.
Led directly to gay marriage in Massachusetts.
Led directly to gay marriage in Massachusetts. And I remember George Will writing a column after the Massachusetts High Court ruled, saying Scalia was dead right, and it is inevitable, based on the legal reasoning, the flawed legal reasoning, to be sure, that same-sex marriage will ultimately be the law of the land. So that's the situation. A constitutional amendment deal is a very difficult thing to achieve to reverse this decision. I think our best hope is the hope that we have pursued with regard to Roe v. Wade, which is win as many elections as we can, confirm as many judicial conservatives as we can, preferably people of Orthodox faith who will not blow with the winds of popular opinion or the media's attempt to get them to change their mind. And then mitigate or overturn this decision. I don't mean to suggest that that's easy. I don't mean to suggest that it will happen overnight. But you and I both know, and everybody knows, that it is only a matter of when, not if, Roe v. Wade is overturned. We are probably one vote away from doing it right now. And Time Magazine was right when they ran that cover story, I think a year and a half or 2 years ago, where they said, the feminist movement won with Roe v. Wade, and they've been losing ever since. There's no question about that. We have chipped away at it. And my advice to our Catholic friends, our evangelical friends, our observant Jew friends, and others who share our values is don't make the mistake of giving up hope now because of this decision. This is a long-term fight. It is a multi-generational fight. You cannot have the word quit in your vocabulary. They don't, and we shouldn't. Remember, Bowers v. Hardwick in 1986 made it clear that was the Boy Scout case. That was the Georgia case that involved the sodomy statute in Georgia. The court upheld that sodomy statute. It was a split decision. Did the gay rights movement throw in the towel? Did they walk away and give up? No, they didn't. They kept coming back. They kept coming back. They ultimately got Lawrence v. Texas. And then, of course, this past week, they got the gay marriage case.
Well, there's always something to learn from a well-armed and successful enemy.
Absolutely. No question about it.
And in this case, what you're saying is, if the gays and the lesbians, suffered defeat after defeat in the early days, but kept growing, getting better organizing, getting better effective with their messaging, infiltrating, cultural institutions such as, public television, also entertainment and movies, then we should be learning from their strategy of getting our message out more effectively into the culture where young people's minds and hearts are shaped. I think we lost gay marriage to the present generation because homosexual lifestyle has been so positively portrayed on television and in the movies.
Yeah, and in a sense that's true. There's no question that they use the institutions that they control, namely the media and the entertainment industries, to push their agenda in a very proactive way. I mean, they had gay characters in every sitcom, and the gay characters were funny, and they were likable, and positively portrayed. And my response to that is, institutions. They are in those positions of influence. They have every right in a free society to advance what they believe in. But let's be clear. Before this decision took place, okay, in spite of all the power that they had only been able to pass same-sex marriage by legislation or amendment or popular vote in 11 out of 50 states deal.
And weren't there 30 states that had affirmed traditional marriage legislatively?
There were 33 states that had affirmed it by a popular referendum or constitutional amendment. There were 39 states that still had same-sex marriage without a constitutional amendment. And by the way, in a place like Florida, where they voted as recently as, I want to say, 2006, which isn't that long ago, to pass that constitutional amendment required a supermajority. Traditional marriage was the law of the land in the fourth largest state in America, a purple state, I might add, by a 61% vote. So what they did was they took the institutions they controlled, the federal courts, the media and entertainment, and they trumped the institutions that we controlled, which was Congress, the various state legislatures, and local officials. They couldn't win that way. And again, even with all that deal, this was a 5-4 decision that, in my opinion, has very little legitimacy.
I'm talking to Ralph Reed, who I want. Ralph, get closer to your phone when you answer the next question. I've been hearing rumblings among Catholics anyway that the church should simply discontinue the practice of certifying marriage civilly, that is, acting for the state in signing marriage licenses. Do you think that's a give-up strategy and a bad idea?
I do. I would defer to the individual churches, denominations, and ecclesiastical leadership to make that call. I mean, that's really ultimately up to them, and I defer to their judgment because that's their area of expertise, not mine. But it seems to me that would be an overreaction to the court's decision, at least now. This is a little bit top of mind for me right now because our oldest daughter was just married 3 weeks
yes.
ago. And, you know, it was a... As it is, I think, for any family, it was a time of tremendous joy and celebration. And it was also an opportunity for us to proclaim the gospel and to lift up Christ and God's plan for marriage. And I think it would be a huge mistake for the church and for people of faith because we lost one narrow, divided political fight to curl up in a fetal position and sort of throw in the towel and say we're going to disengage from having our marriages have any kind of civil connotation. I mean, I think that would be giving them exactly what they wanted.
Giving them, and would it also be giving them exactly what they wanted if some churches began to voluntarily give up their tax status in order to declare their independence from what they consider to be a hostile government?
That one I'd have to think about, but I'd probably feel a little bit differently about that because I would argue that you could make the case that a faith-based charity, even a church, by basically saying, you know what, we don't care whether our contributions are tax-exempt or not. We're more than willing to pay taxes on our contributions so that you can't tell us what to do. You know, sort of like what Hillsdale College has done in a sense, not on the contribution
right.
side, but by refusing government money. I'm not, by the way, I want to be clear, I'm not advocating that. But I see that as a little bit of a different strategy.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's one thing for an isolated college in the middle of nowhere in Michigan of very high educational quality to pull that off. It's quite another for large institutions spread out across the United States to try to make that work.
I agree with that. I can tell you the Faith and Freedom Coalition has a tax-exempt arm, you know, a tax-exempt foundation, and we would not do it. I mean, if the federal government tried to tell us what we could do in a way that restricted our free speech or the exercise of our religion, we would fight them all the way to the Supreme Court and gladly do so. I mean, as you know, when I was at the Christian Coalition in the 90s, we fought the IRS and the Federal Election Commission for 7 or 8 years and won the FEC case on summary judgment before a federal district court. There's nothing new about federal bureaucrats trying to restrict the constitutional rights of conservative people of faith. It's been going on for at least 30 years. It's not new to Lois Lerner, and we shouldn't give up that fight either.
I'm talking with Ralph Reed, a good friend of mine, which I'm very grateful for. I've known him now for nearly 20 years. He is founder and chairman of the Faith and Freedom Coalition, formerly executive director of the Christian Coalition, and truly has forgotten more about politics than most people ever knew. When we come back from this message, we'll be talking more to Ralph Reed about politics, culture, and the church.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchak.
You've heard it said that children are resilient, but it turns out that's not as true as we might like to think. A study in the journal Clinical Neuroimaging reports that children who experienced common family stressors like a lack of affection, marital problems, or poor communication experienced less development in the brain regions responsible for impulse control and stress regulation than did children who were raised in homes without similar stressors. The study is a wake-up call for moms and dads to attend to marriage and parenting struggles promptly. Currently, many couples wait 4 to 6 years before getting professional help. Knowing the effect that marriage and family stress has on our children's developing brains can hopefully encourage parents to get help sooner rather than later. To encourage good impulse control and stress management in our kids, the most important parenting technique is providing our children with a loving, affectionate, peaceful home life. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
How does the Catholic Church regard the economy and social justice? The Catholic Catechism states the development of economic activity and growth in production are meant to provide for the needs of human beings. Economic life, first of all, is ordered to the service of persons, the whole man and the entire human community. Human work comes from persons who have been created in the image and likeness of their Creator God, who commissions them to prolong the work of creation by subduing the earth both with and for one another. Work is a duty, says the Catechism. St. Paul writes, "If anyone will not work, let him not eat." Work honors the gifts and talents God has bestowed on His creatures. Work can be redemptive when its hardships are placed in union with Jesus. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
I'm back with Ralph Reed, who is founder and chairman of the Faith and Freedom Coalition, former executive director of the Christian Coalition. Ralph, among the evangelical community, how is Pope Francis playing? There's been a lot of concern in the Catholic community, especially among conservative Catholics, about his recent encyclical, which they say is on climate change, is actually about much more than that. But obviously John Paul II was much beloved. Benedict XVI was very well liked among evangelicals. How is Pope Francis doing?
Well, I would say John Paul II was really the gold standard in terms of the deep admiration and regard of American evangelicals. And I wrote about that in my book, Awakening, in which, by the way, I consulted
you know, your book, Onward Christian Soldiers, and I think I interviewed you for that book and talking about the historic role of John Paul II in bringing Catholics and evangelicals together.
Yeah, let me just mention that that book was published last year. It's entitled Awakening, How America Can Turn from Moral and Economic Destruction Back to Greatness. That's a book I strongly recommend.
Thank you for the plug. I'm very grateful.
Well, if I'm in it, I got to plug it.
It is available in both hardback and paperback. You get it on Amazon or wherever you want to go. And I think that Francis is really highly regarded for the fact that, at least as far as I'm concerned, I'm only speaking for myself and as one evangelical who, as you know, is a very good friend of the Catholic Church. And has worked in common cause with many Catholics on matters of mutual concern of the common good and of social justice and many other things.
In fact, Ralph, you have helped overcome a lot of resistance among evangelicals about working with Catholics on issues of common concern. I mean, you really have helped to, in a way, create a relationships between evangelical and Catholic leaders that simply weren't there in the early 90s.
And was happy to do so. And for all the reasons that we're talking about, that has changed dramatically. I mean, no question about it. So that has been a big change. I think Francis, in many ways, represents a continuation of that trend, particularly in his discussions about the sanctity of life, the institution of marriage, the need to remain true to defending the sacraments of the faith. I think there are areas where we're going to see things a little differently. I think the recent encyclical in which he talked about the environment would be one of those. I mean, I would argue, for example, and I should say I have not read the encyclical. I am only going off of press accounts, so I'm going to be very ginger in my discussion of his conclusions. But I would argue very strenuously, Gil, that when we look at these kinds of things, first of all, we need to embrace the principle of subsidiarity. If the United Nations or some global consortium of countries is going to be setting the environmental laws of the entire planet, that is not as effective as those governing authorities or mediating institutions closest to the problem. That's number one.
Of course, and subsidiarity is one of the key concepts of Catholic social teaching, as you know.
Of course. I don't really know if that was specifically addressed in the encyclical. That the way in which, for example, having, you know, France, Germany, and other industrialized nations setting environmental laws for developing nations like Africa, many African countries, that frankly still need to grow in order to create wealth. That's the first thing. The second thing is the unintended consequences of well-intentioned policies designed to protect the environment, which end up being devastating to the poor, the downtrodden, and the marginalized. And let me just give you one quick example. And that was the ethanol mandate, originally established by the Bush 43 administration, or at least during the Bush 43 administration, and then sort of raised to the next level by Obama. This, as you know, deal requires, and I can't remember the standard because it moves over the years, but I think it started out that 5% of American gasoline products had to contain ethanol, and then it's designed to go up to 7, 8, 9, 10, and I think ultimately higher. Well, what ended up happening there, Deal, is we ended up at the peak diverting up to one-third of the entire U.S. domestic corn crop, corn harvest, was going to gasoline rather than to corn flakes and foodstuffs.
Right.
With the result being that the cost of basic food staples in developing nations like Mexico and Africa African nations skyrocketed in price so badly that there were food riots in Mexico. So, you know, my point is, look, I believe we have an obligation to be good stewards of the earth. I just think we need to do it in a way that doesn't destroy the economy, kill jobs, and hurt the poor, and isn't based on, you know, frankly, political correctness rather than sound science. So that's where the rub will be.
But there is an aspect of Pope Francis which I would imagine that evangelicals have appreciated, and that is his, you know, very open, large, warm personality. Now, he has a kind of evangelical spirit and presence that, say, Benedict didn't have.
No question. And as I said, I think there are aspects of his papacy and his leadership and his witness that resonate very powerfully with evangelicals, particularly when he talks about the poor. And, you know, I also think when he talks about poverty, one of the things that really impresses me about Pope Francis is he doesn't just address material poverty. He makes the point that ultimately, Gil, what really ails civilization and what really ails our society is spiritual poverty. And it's an attempt to try to substitute the richness of the soul with material goods. And it doesn't work. It has never worked. And I think he's been a very powerful witness of that scriptural truth. You know, the Bible says, man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceedeth forth from the mouth of God. And that's something that the church, I appreciate him using the platform of his papacy to make sure that that truth of the gospel receives the attention that it deserves.
I'm talking with Ralph Reed, former executive director of the Christian Coalition, but now founder and president of the Faith and Freedom Coalition. And Ralph, as you know, I've been sort of present at the creation of the Faith and Freedom Coalition and watched it grow, watched its influence just multiply so quickly. What do you have, about a half a million members at this point?
It's actually about 1,030,000 right now.
And well, you need to update your website, Ralph.
I probably do. When you're growing at a rate of 1,000 members a day, it's really easy for it to get out of date. But
so you have over a million members in Faith and Freedom Coalition.
Yes, we do. And it's going gangbusters. And in 2014, Deal, we distributed over 30 million pieces of voter educational material. We made over 100 million voter contacts. I won't go through all the greatest hits, but we knocked on 161,000 doors in Iowa alone in that major Senate race that Jody Ernst won, becoming the first woman to ever be elected governor or U.S. Senate in the state of Iowa. So, and we also had grassroots efforts underway in North Carolina, in Colorado, in Arkansas, and every other key U.S. Senate state. And, of course, we will do the same in every key battleground state in 2016.
Well, I want our listeners to know where they can get information. I've been on your website today. It's a wonderful, of course, first-class website, very informative, lots of information there. The URL is ffcoalition.com, Faith and Freedom Coalition, but it's very simple, ffcoalition. And I assume, Ralph, that when people go on there, they can sign up as members, they can sign up to get a newsletter. What else can they find on your website?
Well, they can find our congressional scorecard that details how their member of Congress has voted on key issues affecting the family. They can find out about our training seminars. We do citizen action seminars all over the country in which we teach evangelicals, faithful Catholics, and other people of faith the basic blocking and tackling of how to be an effective citizen, how to get involved in the political party of your choice, how to, you know, how to influence the media and other things that they need to know to be effective.
And I would assume that, I know when you were with the Christian Coalition, nearly half of your members were Catholic. Do you have any idea of what percentage of your million-plus members at Faith and Freedom are Catholic?
You know, the most recent time that I checked that deal, and it's probably been over a year ago, we were hovering between 20 and 25%, which is about what it is for the population as a whole.
Well, I hope that our listeners, who are, I think, mostly Catholic, will definitely go on the Faith and Freedom Coalition website and sign up to at least get the kind of information that you need to be prepared politically to engage effectively. So many people of goodwill, Ralph, as you know, they charge into politics and they just kind of trip all over themselves because, as you say, they haven't been schooled in the basic blocking and tackling, even of messaging.
Yeah, no, that's right, and that's why we teach them the basics of how they can be effective. And, you know, citizenship is not something that you're born with, any more than you're born with the basic disciplines of your faith. It's something that you need to learn, and a lot of Christians unfortunately think, you know, well, all I got to do is read the newspaper and go vote.
Well, that's the last place you want to get your information, newspaper, right?
Yeah, or listen to talk radio or watch Fox News, whatever it may be. And what we teach them is, no, you need to get involved and make a difference by becoming an effective citizen in your community.
In other words, practice subsidiarity. You know.
In other words, practice subsidiarity. And one thing that we really emphasize, Deal, you know, look, we don't think that the church is the Republican Party of prayer or the Democratic Party of prayer, for that matter. But we do think that the way that you can maximize your effectiveness as a citizen is to become involved in the political party of your choice. If you vote in primary, if you're a campaign volunteer, if you're a party official, your role in the process is exaggerated as opposed to just when you, you know, you just show up and vote.
But I wonder, Ralph, you know, we're looking at a GOP presidential list now that's almost like a conga line. It's getting so long. Should we, pro-life, pro-family, traditional values voters, I mean, should we be glad that there are so many good candidates, or should we be worried that they're all going to cancel each other out?
I lean much more strongly on the former. I think it is a sign of our strength and not our weakness. And I think if you look at this field, you've got faithful Catholics like Rick Santorum.
Bobby Jindal.
Bobby Jindal.
Marco Rubio, Jeb Bush.
He's a convert, by the way. Marco Rubio, Jeb Bush, who's a convert. If you are a faithful Catholic, there has never been a field this strong. I mean, when you get to choose just on the Catholic side between Rick Santorum, one of the most effective legislators of the last 30 years on our values, Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, or Bobby Jindal. And then on the evangelical side, you have, in addition to all those candidates, Scott Walker, who's the son of an evangelical preacher, Mike Huckabee, who's a former preacher, Ted Cruz, who's the son of, if not a preacher, certainly an evangelical.
No, he's definitely a preacher. There's no question.
Ben Carson, and I could go on. This is the strongest and deepest field that contains more genuine men and women of faith, by the way, including Carly Fiorina.
Absolutely.
Who is deeply committed Christian, than we have ever seen. And my argument is, you know, quit worrying about, quote-unquote, dividing the vote or canceling each other out. I think that is very narrow thinking. It reduces the faith community to an interest group.
that is trying to unite behind one candidate, that's not the way to think about it.
Well, it looks at it as a zero-sum game, like, that you have just so much of a pie that can be divided.
Right.
It could be the case that this many candidates are actually bringing new people into the coalition.
The way to think about this is as a public witness. And particularly at a moment like this, to go back to where we started with the marriage decision, are you telling me that you only want one candidate to be talking about why marriage should be between a man and a woman and why this is judicial overreach so that we can all be behind one candidate? I want them all to be saying that. And they are. And so, believe you me, this is a sign of the fruit of the harvest of the sowing and the reaping that we have been doing for 30 years with the Republican Party.
That's a really good point, Ralph. Really good point. I'm talking to Ralph Reed, founder and president of the Faith and Freedom Coalition. I want to ask you about Donald Trump because I know you know him because he spoke at one of your dinners a few years ago. By the way, one of the best dinner speeches I've ever heard. I must say he really knows how to deliver a message. Is he really as much on our side on these issues as he says he is?
Well, I can't judge his heart, but I can tell you that I have talked to him about it, and I have talked to him specifically about where he stands on issues of concern to the faith community, including marriage and life and religious freedom. And he has assured me and has publicly stated that he is pro-life, pro-marriage, and believes in religious freedom and liberty. And so we have welcomed him at our events. He has spoken at Faith and Freedom events. He was not able to make Road to Majority, our recent D.C. conference, but he has been there twice before. And my sense is that because of where he stands on these issues, like Carly Fiorina, somebody from the business community who can say, I'm with you, I stand with you, and proudly so, he is going to get a fair hearing. He will get heard. He will be able to make his case. How he does will be determined by how well of a campaign he runs and how people respond to him. But I can assure you he will get a fair hearing.
Well, I think standing up to NDC on the issue of immigration is a pretty good start.
Yeah, and I think he is somebody who is not intimidated by or cowed by the media. And I think a lot of grassroots conservatives respond to that, needless to say. I mean, Deal, I was in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, I guess it's now been 3.5 years ago, when ABC was running a special or some extra day on Newt Gingrich, a previous marriage. And his ex-wife was making some rather explosive charges against him. And that night, I believe it was John King with CNN, who, by the way, I think is a good and fair reporter. But he asked the question about Newt's previous marriage. And Newt basically, I don't think I overstated, essentially jumped down his throat and said, when we are dealing with things like international terrorism, the economic problems we're dealing with, a broken healthcare system, a broken educational system, how you could begin this debate by making that your very first question shows me how biased the media is and, you know, whatever it was he said. Obviously, I'm paraphrasing.
I was there that night. I remember vividly.
I was there, and 5,000 people rose to their feet
right
in a spontaneous standing ovation. So, you know, we'll see what happens with Trump, but I can certainly tell you that conservatives respond to people who stand up to the media.
You know, one reason, Ralph, I've been particularly interested in the candidacy of Carly Fiorina is not only because I'm so impressed with her many abilities, particularly her ability to handle hostile press. She has an amazing gift. But she's a woman, and if it if it turns out that Hillary Clinton is the Democratic nominee, the only issue that she will run on, and she may hardly ever mention it, is the fact that there needs to be a female president. That will be the sub rosa message of her entire campaign. And if Fiorina is at least on the ticket, it would take some of the pop out of that particular message.
I think that's right. I think it's important for us to have telling women spokesperson. I think we've frankly got a number of them. I really like what Nikki Haley has been doing in South Carolina. I think she made a real name for herself, not that she needed to. She already was very well known and highly regarded. The way she handled the recent issue related to the Confederate flag in South Carolina and the recent tragic shooting there. And you've got a number of others. Governor Susana Martinez, New Mexico, Kristi Noem, Congresswoman from South Dakota. There's a lot of good stuff going on out there, and every one of those women is pro-life, and I'm very impressed by a lot of them. I think we've got a very good story to tell, and I'm not going to predict either the nominee or the running mate, but I think there's a lot of talent out there, Gail.
Ralph, we have 5 minutes left, and I know, very few people know, that you have a Ph.D. in history from Emory, and you wrote your dissertation on a subject that is about the American South. So I'm particularly interested in what you think of this incredible, what I think, overreaction to what is definitely a tragedy, but to start defacing statues of Robert E. Lee, to begin to try to take all images of the Confederate flag out of circulation, to talk about, you know, putting Gone with the Wind back into the MGM vaults. I mean, what is going on here, Ralph?
You know, I haven't really been able to follow those aspects of it, deal, but I think, I grew up in the South. I'm also somebody who believes very strongly in building a colorblind society where everyone is treated with equal dignity and respect, regardless of their race, their ethnicity, or any other characteristic. And I wrote about this in Awakening. I talked about how America's original sin, to borrow a phrase from Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the sin of racism, how that has haunted America and why we need to fully repent and ask for God's forgiveness before we can really totally experience his abundance and his protection. And it's a tough issue, it's a difficult issue, but I think if there is moral courage and there is leadership, as we saw from Governor Haley and many others over the years, I think we can get there. It's going to be a long process.
Do you think America has repented? Do you think that repentance is behind us, or are we still in the process of it?
I think we're still in the process of it. I think there have been a lot of really good things that have happened. Remember that racial reconciliation and repentance was one of the four key principles of Promise Keepers back in the 1990s.
Yeah.
And, you obviously know that, David Beasley, who was governor of South Carolina back in the 90s and originally tried to deal with this issue of the flag in South Carolina. I was privileged as state party chairman of Georgia to work very closely with another evangelical, Governor Sonny Perdue, who oversaw the changing of our state flag. But it has to be done in a way that doesn't accuse people who are trying to acknowledge the unique heritage of the South, of being bigot.
Ralph, we've run out of time, and I know you need to get on a plane.
Well, I do indeed.
So Ralph Reed, founder and chairman of the Faith and Freedom Coalition, author of Awakening, How America Can Turn from Moral and Economic Destruction Back to Greatness. Once again, I want our listeners to go to your website at ffcoalition.com. Ralph, thanks for being a guest again on Church and Culture.
Thank you so much, Gil.
And to all of your listening, please come back after this short message for another very interesting guest.
If you want to use your gifts and talent to support women and the unborn, contact the Arbor Women Pregnancy Center to volunteer. Arbor Women needs pro-life people to support, nurture, and empower women facing unexpected pregnancies. Arbor Women are in need of nurses and sonographers with a current Michigan license, as well as pregnancy and post-abortion counselors. Call the volunteer coordinator at 734-994-8863. That's 734-994-8863 to learn how you can help.
This is Father Frank Pavone of Priests for Life. Our Priests for Life headquarters is within easy driving distance of the Statue of Liberty in New York. This statue is a strong symbol of the welcome our nation has given to people from around the world. Fittingly engraved on the base of this monumental statue are the words from Emma Lazarus' poem, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free." As we prepare for the celebration of Independence Day, let's remind ourselves and others that this welcome can make no sense if we are afraid to welcome the children in the womb. America is a haven for those escaping oppression in far-off lands. Why should it be the land where we oppress the unborn by the violence of abortion? This is Father Frank Pavone on Ave Maria Radio.
Fully Alive. Reflections on the scripture readings of today's Mass with Father Pat Egan, chaplain of Ave Maria Radio.
People of Nazareth rejected Jesus. Sunday's Gospel tells us of this sad incident. Jesus comes home after his first preaching tour, returning a celebrity and a miracle worker. But his own people turn on him and refuse to believe. How sad. He so wanted to bless them. Jesus came to his native place accompanied by his disciples, and when the Sabbath came, he began to teach in the synagogue. Many who heard him were astonished. They said, "Where did this man get all this? What kind of wisdom has been given him? What mighty deeds are wrought by his hands? Isn't he the carpenter, the son of Mary, the brother James, Joseph, Judas, and Simon? And aren't his sisters here with us?" And they took offense at him. So Jesus said to them, "A prophet is not without honor except in his native place and among his own kin and in his own house. So he's not able to perform any mighty deed there, apart from curing a few sick people." He was amazed at their lack of faith. A comment about the words brother and sister here. In Aramaic idiom, they could refer to a wide bunch of relatives, nieces and nephews, half-brothers and cousins, not just to blood brothers and sisters, as we use it. Perhaps a better English word would be relatives. We too have to be careful about not resisting Jesus. So often our pride and self-sufficiency can get in the way. Allow Jesus to bless you by becoming humble and non-self-assertive. I'm Father Pat Egan, chaplain to Ave Maria Radio, commenting on the readings read today at Mass. Remember, inspired by the Word of God, you can be more fully alive.
This is Lavinia Spirito for Catholic Way Bible Study. The Bible is full of references of the importance of reading God's Word. For example, Paul's letter to the Hebrews says,